The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League, Manchester City see off Real Madrid. How good were Pep's men? Will they win it? And how many will Phil Foden score for England in the final of Euro 21? And what of Real, a real Varanarama performance from them? Elsewhere, Juve are out, but Pirlo is in. We'll ask the big question, will he wear one of Sarri's old tracksuits for his first game? As expected, Bayern see off Chelsea and Lionel Messi is good again. In the Europa, Wolves featuring Adama Traore and his well-oiled arms are through. We'll look ahead to the quarterfinals for them and Manchester United. In Fitbar, Hibs, Rangers and Ross County surge clear of Celtic, while Aberdeen's squad forget about the pandemic. It's not really been in the news, has it? We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Week. Lee says, looking at that happy panel of contributors, who will sigh the most during the pod? Welcome, Jonathan Wilson.
Ronnie.
Hello, Barney Ronnie.
Hi, Max.
Hi, Barry.
Hello, Max.
You'll be pleased to know that Harry tweeted, three syringes, which I think he means inject this podcast into my veins. He was so excited about the lineup in front of him.
Maybe he thinks we're on performance-enhancing drugs.
Well, I would suggest we're probably not on enough of those, if that is the case.
Right, where should we start? So we start at the Etihad then, Manchester City 2, Real Madrid 1. Barney, how convincing a victory was this, do you think?
Yeah, it was pretty convincing. I mean, I went to the first leg of this game, and it was just after City had been banned, and before, around about the time they launched their appeal. And I thought their performance there was, I mean, that's where they won the tie. And they were fantastic. I thought, really good. And they had this weird light around them, you know, this wronged team, which, even though, you know, forget the reasons for the ban, I found very seductive. They suddenly seemed like this bunch of driven outsiders. You know, I kind of could suddenly buy into the idea of why people get so attracted to these things. But I thought they were really good. And Real Madrid had, you know, they're all getting a bit older, but they had that incredible midfield that's so sort of garlanded. And City just played brilliantly. And if you look at it, I when I saw the City team, I kind of thought, oh, okay, there's a few spots in that team. You look at it and you don't say, well, that's an absolute double A class footballer in that position. But they played brilliantly as a team. He picked the right team. And Phil Foden was very good.
Yeah. Johnny Lou wrote a piece about Phil Foden, about saying that this is a real moment, Barry, where he started him ahead of the Silvers, ahead of Riyad Mahrez. This is a big sort of statement of Pep to Phil Foden, and Phil Foden took the chance with both hands, didn't he?
Yeah, he was very impressive. I suppose a couple of years ago, or at least a year ago anyway, people were saying he should perhaps move on in a bid to get first team football somewhere else, because his chances were limited at City, but he stayed put. Presumably he was assured that his opportunity would come, and that seemed like quite a big statement the other night. There's no doubt he's good enough to play for City on a regular basis, and with David Silva on the way out, there's a place there for him if his performances remain of a suitably high standard.
Wilson, at what point does Gareth Southgate build the whole England team around him, and how certain are you now that England will win the European Championships?
I'm not even certain the European Championships will happen, so I think there's a few bridges to be crossed first. I mean, the thing that struck me was, yeah, excellent the City were, and they clearly pressed brilliantly, and Gabriel Jesus is really good at performing that role, and Foden clearly is very good at that as well. It was just how bad Real Madrid were. I mean, it was 2-1, but it could have been, it probably should have been 5-0. I guess there's two sides to that. One is, it was just staggering how Real Madrid clearly are not used to being pressed, they're not used to being challenged, and as soon as they were, they just went to pieces. I mean, how often in that first half, well, and the second half as well, but I guess we got used to it by then, but how often did they just give the ball away? Courtois, I guess the one criticism of him throughout his career has been he's not that great with the ball at his feet. Carvajal looked hopeless at that. Varane obviously made the two mistakes. You know, the player who we thought might be the weak link, Eder Militao, was actually the only Real Madrid player, only Real Madrid defending, who was never dispossessed in the game. I mean, I know this is a thing I say again and again and again, but it is just sort of evidence of this decadence of the super clubs that they cannot deal with being challenged. The other side of it is a slight concern I have for City, is that having dominated to such an extent, they only win 2-1. And it's the thing that Guardiola has said repeatedly over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, that occasionally they just lack something in both boxes. They're not quite ruthless enough in front of the goal, and they are slightly fragile defensively. And the fact that Real Madrid even threatened to get back into it briefly in the first half would concern me slightly going forward.
I agree. I mean, I think it's part of City's charm as a team is that kind of massively convincing, suddenly massively brittle thing that they kind of have. And what I was trying to say when I was saying that you didn't look at them and think what a frightening 11 that is, without Aguero, they don't have that really lethal player. And yet they've still beaten the Spanish champions, who may be a decadent super club, home and away. I had this idea the other day when I was like, I feel a bit sad. It's a sad thing to think about when I was half asleep, that City should sign Harry Kane. I know Spurs fans would like to hear that. But can you imagine him in that team? How many goals he'd score? He'd score 400 goals a season. And he can also do the kind of pressing and stuff that Jesus is good at. He's, a really underrated, intelligent footballer. I mean, if you were to put Harry Kane into City's team, I think they'd be absolutely lethal for 2 years. But I agree, they don't. That's what a part of their charm. They don't rely on having absolutely deadly players who will kill a game for you. The system will either work or it won't work. And when it works, it's great.
Did you see the Twitter thread, which is the new he's not 28 until he's 29 discussion of Harry Kane going to Manchester City?
No. Is that a thing? Is that people suggesting that?
It is a thing because Lord Sugar tweeted, rumour Man City to bid £200 million for Harry Kane, to which Paul said, he isn't worth that, £75 million at most, to which Maverick Spur said, he's worth whatever Spurs say he is given the length of his contract. To which Richard said, that's not how it works. I want £2.6 million for my toaster, but it doesn't mean it's worth that. To which Maverick Spur says, that's exactly how it works. If I want to buy your toaster, I have to pay you what you want to get it. It continues. Richard says, no, that's how much he's for sale for, not his worth. You go and buy a different toaster somewhere else that does the same thing for better value. Maverick Spur says, but I really only want your toaster. It's up to me to decide if it's worth the £2.6 million or not. Richard, exactly. So he's not worth whatever Spurs say he's worth. Barney.
What kind of toaster is this?
What that discussion is not even addressed is how many years the toaster got left in its contract? What's it getting paid? Because presumably you could just pay up the remainder of the contract to release that toaster from its bondage in whichever kitchen it was in. I mean, it's just awful that the toasters now, they're just looking for the next deal. I remember when you'd get a toaster and it would stay there for 10 or 12 years. It would be committed to the club. You could emotionally invest in that toaster, and it would be heating up bread and making it crispy, and you could enjoy that. And now, as soon as it toasts a good tea cake, you think, well, it's off next season.
I have nothing to say about kitchen appliances. in examples, Barry, of this tweet didn't age well, did you see our friend Musa Okwonga's quite brilliant tweet about 20 minutes before kickoff?
No.
In the modern era, is there a footballer with a greater level of low-key greatness than Raphael Varane? Has there ever been anyone more quietly brilliant year in, year out? If your answer is yes, please put your suggestions below. And he did a Twitter poll, and most people, I think it was like 51%, said yes, Varane is the greatest low-key great player. And it was just, it was as if Varane had seen that tweet, because Musa's right. No one has talked about Raphael Varane ever in the history of football until this football match. Would you say, Barney, that Varane is the greatest low-key footballer ever?
No, maybe. I mean, I've never even heard of him. Has he ever won anything or played for any big teams? I mean, it's possibly the case if you're looking a certain sort of source of information only. But I think it would be hard to really suggest that he's a strangely overlooked and underrated person. He's pretty good in the World Cup.
I do think, though, Wilson, and I understand the idea of, I don't want to sound like Big Sam, the idea of playing out from the back. But do you think it is slightly different in these one-off games where they're just easy goals not to concede? And conceding goals is quite important.
Yes, but if you're a team who habitually plays out from the back, and if you're Real Madrid, who've just won the Spanish Championship, I think you're probably pretty good at that. And certainly with one of the real sort of philosophy teams, you know, with I mean, I remember that Clásico in Guardiola's penultimate season at Barca when they conceded the goal after, I don't know, 3 minutes or something because Victor Valdez had mishit a pass out from the back. And the next time he got the ball, he still played the short pass out to the fullback. And whatever he said then was, isn't this brilliant? He knows that error's not going to be held against him because he'll do that 200 times and 199 times. It'll actually get them in a better position. It'll draw Real Madrid onto them. It'll create space elsewhere. So, you know, if your whole way of playing is built around that, and if you are quite good at that, I'm not sure you should be changing it. I guess if you're somebody like, I mean, we saw it when Brighton played Liverpool recently, and maybe if you're Brighton against Liverpool, when you clearly have a talent deficiency compared to Liverpool, maybe you do have to go slightly more pragmatic. But equally, I kind of think if you're Brighton, you're probably not going to win that game anyway. Why not test yourself doing what you're trying to do against the very best?
And just to sort of back that up, you may have been there as well. You remember the famous What Is Tackles press conference after Man City?
I wasn't there, no, but I remember it, against Leicester.
City lost against Leicester and there'd been a bit of sort of faffing around at the back. The Vardy had kind of closed them down. And what you didn't really get a transcript off from that was Guardiola actually spoke really interestingly about this process. And his point, which he would make were he on this podcast sitting in front of a big thing of books with like Wilson's books behind him and copies of Wisden, he would probably say, do you have the same numbers for the amount of goals conceded by people booting the ball out? His contention is that long clearances from the back very often lead to goals as well, because you're giving the opposition the ball. And if you actually run the numbers, more goals are given away by just get rid of it than by people making those very obvious cinematic errors everyone can point to and say, oh, look, he's given the ball away to Lacazette and they've scored. What a fool. His point is we give away fewer goals doing that than we do hoofing it to the halfway line, which is quite an interesting point.
Yeah, well, I think the argument is it's sort of analogous with the argument about man marking and zonal marking at corners, that when zonal marking goes wrong, it looks horrendous, but you just don't notice it when it goes right. And so what you're trying to do, you're trying to do what's best in, you know, in the round, or are you trying to do the thing that avoids a really embarrassing mistake everybody sort of points at and laughs at on Twitter for 48 hours?
When zonal marking goes wrong is not one of the best kind of Jeopardy shows that they have on day, isn't it? Late at night with fishing trawlers. And after us, when zonal marking goes wrong.
Man City Michael Cox in Falling Down. Shooting up at McDonald's.
Do you think City will go all the way, Baz?
I personally don't. I think they will get to the final and I think they will lose against Bayern Munich.
No, that's not possible.
Yes, it is. No, it's not possible. Bollocks.
It's possible in your world. They'll lose to Bayern Munich in the semi-final.
Can I just, in Mali in 2002, I went to visit a witch doctor during the Cup of Nations, and I asked him who was going to win the World Cup that summer, and he said, I think he said Argentina will beat Germany in the final, and I pointed out that wasn't possible because they were on the same half of the draw. And he went very calmly, then they will change the draw.
Personally, I don't think they will win. I would think Bayern Munich will be very hard to beat. But if they meet in the semi-final, that is a game I would look forward to very much. I've been very impressed by Bayern Munich. And I think they look less fallible than City. But obviously, on their day, City can beat anyone.
We'll talk about Bayern's victory over Chelsea in a second. Before that, City will play Lyon after Lyon knocked out Juventus, going through 2-2 on aggregate. David said, what is 2020's witch's curse? Juve to never win the Champions League. Obviously, Sarri lost his job after this. Pirlo's got the job. Before we talk about that, let's talk about the game. Barney, there was and I know you love banging the VAR drum. There was lots of fun VAR in this one, wasn't there? A couple of penalties that were never penalties any day of the week.
I mean, the different interpretations of VAR is a thing that has kind of added new layers, hasn't it? Becoming incredibly upset about the way different authorities seem to interpret it has given us more sort of juice and more oil for this discussion. I mean, the if we're going to do VAR, the one that really got me was the penalty in the Barcelona game, which I seem to be the only person who thought that was a totally ridiculous decision, where he kicked Messi, literally trying to clear the ball. It was Koulibaly, wasn't it? And there seems to be a new idea that if you literally jump in front of someone's foot while they're trying to kick the ball, you've been fouled and you can have a penalty, which is what happened there. I mean, I know it's boring, but every one of these discussions ends with the same ultimate answer, that it's being very badly administered. And that you either get rid of it, which obviously not going to happen, but some sort of total just culling of an entire bureaucracy, the sort of thing that would happen in Stalinist Russia, just a purge where suddenly everyone is taken, you know, and kind of shot in a ditch, would probably help. But yeah, I think it's the way it's being administered doesn't help.
Sorry, Barney, are you saying you think that Koulibaly didn't foul Messi?
Yeah. I think he was just trying to kick the ball, and unbeknownst to him, a foot appeared in front of his kicking foot.
Still a foul.
But he hooked Messi's foot away from him.
Now, Messi did very well to nip in there, like, I'm going to surprise this guy. But it's not a foul if you're just trying to kick the ball and someone steps in front of your kicking foot. It's legitimate to kick the ball. That's allowed. No, well, what was he supposed to do? How could he stop his leg?
But sometimes it's not intentional, but it's still a foul.
I'm not saying intentional, but kicking a ball is allowed. If someone leaps in front of your kicking foot and there is literally physically no way of stopping it, so you could just run around the pitch anticipating when someone's going to kick the ball and lying down in front of it, and you win endless penalties. I mean, to me, it's totally...
You know, that's putting your body in between the ball and the other player. Wilson, thoughts?
I thought that was a penalty. I actually thought the Leon penalty was a penalty, because it's not the foul by Bentancur. It's the Bernardeschi clips
okay.
his heel.
Okay.
And that's why he's starting to go down when Bentancur slides in. So I actually think that's... I would accept that it's a penalty that would almost certainly not have been given, or not have been given for the right reasons without VAR. But I think it probably is where VAR maybe is a good thing, that clip of the heel we wouldn't otherwise have been aware of. And actually still took ages to kind of realise that was what had been given for, that had happened.
How impressed were you with Leon, given that they haven't really played football for months and months and then just turned up and got a result in Turin?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been fortunate that the two games they've played since they came back, both of them, all they've done is sit back and try and absorb pressure. So the game against PSG in the Coupe de la Ligue final, when they got a 0-0 draw, then lost on penalties. And that one, they were very similar, just sort of sit in and hope for the best. And yeah, they do have, if you look at their defensive record this season, I think they've let in just under a goal a game in the league. They haven't let in more than two in any Champions League game. So they clearly do have a bit of resolve and a bit of organisation there. So I guess they can cause City problems in the quarterfinal with that. But I mean, I think they're pretty limited going forward. But this was more about Juve being hopeless. I mean, they're a terrible football team. They're a disgrace with the amount of money they've got. Yeah, you know, the way everything goes through Ronaldo, you know, is a question. Why would you point Sarri and then make him play through Ronaldo? It's just nonsense. Not his type of football.
Yeah, that combination, you're right, is completely insane.
Yeah, you know, Ronaldo scored 31 goals this season in the league. I think Dybala's got 14. Higuain got 7. So that's your three forwards. And Higuain, you know, has been a sort of reserve, occasionally coming off the bench. The highest scoring midfielder has got 3. Yeah, everything is through Ronaldo. And it's this sort of really sort of basic play through your star football. It's the kind of thing you do. You know, it's like watching Liberia when George Weah was there. You know, a team that happens to have one massive star and then a load of kind of, you know, of much lesser quality players where they feel everything has to go through him. And it's just, you know, it was easy for Leon to defend against it because they just put four men around Ronaldo and that's it. Ronaldo still scored twice because he's still a brilliant player. But he didn't move.
Well, the part of this whole story that interested me most was the talk of Maurizio Sarri's £21 million payoff for losing his job. I mean, it's just amazing. What a brilliant day for him. I mean, what an incredible thing. Like, imagine how many fags he can buy and tracksuits.
Not that many fags. They're very expensive these days.
But this is the greatest moment of his life. He's been given £21 million to stop doing a job. I mean, that's just incredible. But it was always, as Jonathan says, it was a very strange meeting of two worlds. This kind of idea, you sign Ronaldo, who's obviously an incredible player, but you're signing him for his star power. really, and to play through him. And then you kind of employ this manager of this kind of collectivism football. It doesn't make any sense. So in a way, appointing Pirlo, who's presumably agreed to do whatever he's told to do, who is also a celebrity appointment, makes kind of sense in a way. It's like, why not go all in with that? You know, why not sign a whole load more? Billy the Fish, you know, why not get, you know, other famous people in the team and just go all in? It's an amazing
Nick story. Hocknell and Gary Kemp.
Yeah, you know, they're all singing from the same hymn sheet, aren't they? I mean, it's just the thing with Pirlo, it's only this time last year he enrolled to do his coaching badges. It's an incredible story of social mobility and the fact that anybody anywhere can become a leading football manager. It's open to anyone. Just do your coaching badges and you'll get a top job.
I mean, the Pirlo decision is a complete joke. It just makes Juventus look ridiculous. I mean, it's not impossible. It might work, but there's no logic behind it. It's basically every super club looks at what happened with Guardiola at Barcelona and thinks, yeah, we want that. So that's why Chelsea appoint Lampard. It's why United appoint Solskjaer. They want their former star to turn up and somehow be a brilliant coach. Now, it happened to work with Guardiola, but Guardiola did have a body of work behind him. You know, he had spent the final years of his career.
I disagree. I don't think that's what's happening here. You're imputing too much logic to them. I think what's happening is this is to do with marketing, which the Guardiola thing obviously wasn't.
Yeah, but of course this is what I'm saying, that Pirlo has no body of work. His body of work is 9 days in charge of the under-23s. Now, those first training sessions must have been sensational.
you wonder how it's going to go down in Italy, where they do actually, you know, the idea of tactics and having a method is really respected. You know, there's no anti-intellectualism in Italian football. Remember being in a press conference at Juve, there was this voice, it was a stampede and people leaping up and down. I thought, what's happened? Has somebody refused to shake hands with someone? Has somebody snubbed someone or something like this? Something big had happened. And it was to do with the guy was talking about switching to a back three and people reacted as though this was like an outrage. You know, my God, front page of the newspaper. They respect tactics. They respect people with, as you say, a body of work. And this decision will, if it doesn't work, we'll be torn to pieces, surely.
Can I read you some words from Andrea Pirlo's autobiography? I've got a few quotes from his autobiography, which are excellent. After the wheel, the PlayStation is the best invention of all time. The best ideas come about in moments of total concentration, a state you can reach when shitting. And on warm-ups, have you heard his quote on just warming up? I hate it with every fibre of my being. It actually disgusts me. It's nothing but masturbation for conditioning coaches, their way of enjoying themselves at the player's expense. I'm looking forward to seeing how he does the Juve warm-up before their first game. Christian says, Barry, who looks more elegant at the sidelines, Sarri in Pirlo's clothes or Pirlo in Sarri's clothes?
Oh, I mean, Pirlo would look elegant in anything, I'd imagine. We discussed yesterday, I think he should go for the Bob Stokoe 73 Cup Final touchline attire, brown Mac, trilby, red tracksuit trousers and stout brogues. But, yeah, he'd look good in pretty much anything.
I very much hope he goes full Pulis. Yes, Barney?
I was interesting about Pirlo. You know, there's often this thing that people say, really brilliant players can't it's very hard for them to transfer their brilliance to lesser players. You know, the Bobby Charlton thing of whacking a ball onto the crossbar from the centre circle to show everyone how to do it, while his Preston players sort of looked at him saying, who is this alien? How do I possibly try to compete with him? I'm not sure in Pirlo's case that necessarily translates, because he was not a super athlete. If anything, he was a fairly average athlete. His brilliance was in his ability to see space and use it. And perhaps those sort of skills, you know, he's an extremely tactically smart player. Perhaps that sort of understanding of the game can be I remember watching that game in Kiev with him. One of my favourite memories of sitting with Richard Williams. We were watching the England game where Pirlo was incredible and England were pretty dire. And no, we didn't say anything for half an hour. Nothing happened except Pirlo passing the ball. And me and Richard didn't say anything. Eventually, in sort of the deep into stoppage time, Richard turned to me and said, it's as though he's the only grown-up on the pitch. which I just thought was like a brilliant remark from TV's Richard Williams, who's very good at making remarks. But it was true. And I know maybe that kind of understanding of where to stand, where to park, maybe you can communicate that. Maybe he's a natural manager. We shall see.
Well, Man City will play Lyon 8 o'clock UK time Saturday in Lisbon. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Bayern Munich's 4-1 victory over Chelsea. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jonathan Wilson, Barney Runay and Barry Glendening, your panel today. Bayern Munich 4, Chelsea 1, 7-1 on aggregate. Jay Fitz said, please skip the Chelsea analysis. Very pleased Wilson isn't involved on this one. And then Jay Fitz went, ah, oh, shit, Wilson is on this one. Over to you, Jonathan Wilson.
I mean, it was a hopeless task for Chelsea. We were never going to get back in the game. What could they possibly do? I mean, if they were realistically going to try and overturn that 3-goal deficit to do something that had never been done before against the best team in the world at the moment, they had to attack, which is going to open them up on the counter-attack, which is what they're really bad at anyway. So they were always going to be heavily defeated. And you know, I think what was really impressive was how focused Bayern's pressing was and the sense they gave that they still had 2 or 3 gears to go through. So I think Bayern are by a long way the best team in the competition at the moment.
But as you said, you have them as favourites. They've beaten Chelsea and Spurs this season by an aggregate score of 17-4. Lewandowski, top scorer in the competition, 13 this season, joint most assists. They're a wonderful football team, aren't they?
They're fantastic. Lewandowski is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's a bit of a humiliation for Frank Lampard, particularly, and it may cost him the Premier League Manager of the Year award. I see he was on the shortlist, the 4-man shortlist. But I wouldn't judge him on this result. As Jonathan says, they were kind of on a hide into nothing. It was in the first leg they lost it. But it's hard to pick any weak spot in the Bayern side. They may not win the tournament, but I definitely concur that they are the best team in it.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching this game too. And I think it will be tempting to be a bit harsh on Lampard because his team have been picked apart by far superior team. But I was also reminded of how young a lot of the Chelsea players are and inexperienced. I mean, Callum Hudson-Odoi, you know, he had an okay game, I thought, but I mean, he's really just left school. He's so young and not played much. And Reece James also, he's got that thing of playing really good crosses into a good area, but nobody's ever there. He really looks like an academy player to me. There's that feeling sometimes with these players that you've been told to do this and you keep doing it. I've seen him hit the ball about 30 times this season, a really good whipped cross, which is nowhere near any Chelsea players. I feel these are quite inexperienced players who can deceive you into thinking they're a bit further along the line than they are because they're talented and well-drilled and all that kind of thing. I also enjoyed the point of, I love it when you watch the highlights, where a team scores what will turn out to be a consolation goal and runs into the net to bring the ball back to the centre circle just so they can get thrashed even more. I think that's a kind of definition of dramatic irony, isn't it? You're running back so the opposition can score more goals. But it's a sign of, you know, they were just against
them. In my mind, that is David Platt in an Arsenal shirt. I don't know why. I can just see David Platt doing that really, really well. And obviously, another really good part of that is occasionally, as you saw in the playoff final, you have a little bit of a set two between goalkeeper and man trying to get the ball, which is one of my favourite things to see in a football match. Willian Wilson, 7 years he was at Stamford Bridge. My first reaction was 7 years. God, that has gone quickly. He's played 339 games for the club. He says, the time has now come to move on. I leave with my head held high, safe in the knowledge that I won things here and always did my best in a Chelsea shirt. I think I have underestimated, A, how long he was there and B, what he's achieved for Chelsea.
Yeah, he's a player who slightly confuses me because every time I see him, I think he looks really good. And in a Brazil shirt, in a Chelsea shirt, before that when he was at Shakhtar, and I really like him as a player. I think he's kind of a very modern winger that he's very hardworking as well as being creative. He takes a great free kick. But I am aware there's a section of Chelsea fans who are a bit suspicious of him, that they don't think he's... A number of Chelsea fans have said to me, oh, well, you don't see him every week. I said, well, I don't see him every week, but I do probably see him live maybe I don't know, 20 times a year, and he's good in most of those 20 games. Yeah, I think he's been a great player for them. And the fact Chelsea were willing to offer him a two-year contract, I think, is significant, given he's 32 now. He wanted 3 years, which I guess when you're getting to that stage of your career, you want that extra security. And I'm sure Arsenal are going to give him loads of money for it. But I think he's a really... If you leave the money aside, I think he's certainly for the next year or two, he's a really good player for Arsenal to have. Whether he's a good signing, given that he'll be 35 when his contract expires, given he's presumably on a massive wage, it's a slightly different issue. But as a player, I think he's a really, really good player and will be really useful to for Arteta to get his ideas across to those younger forwards he's got of the industry you've got to put in as well as the talent.
Barcelona 3, Napoli 1. Barry, Lionel Messi was ridiculously good again, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He scored a wonderful goal. He had another wonderful goal disallowed when he chested down a cross from Frankie de Jong, a wonderful cross, chested it down, buried it, and was adjudged to have... Well, he wasn't adjudged. The ball did glance against his upper arm as he chested it down. An issue with the handball law. There were several VAR interventions in this game. The Koulibaly one that Barney referred to earlier, I thought it was a penalty, but it took over 4 minutes to award it. I thought it was one of the most obvious penalties I've ever seen, because Koulibaly did hook, in my view, Messi's leg from under him. But Barcelona won quite comfortably, but were very unimpressive, largely. Gerard Piqué had stood out, Messi stood out, and the rest of them... They were okay, but Napoli didn't really bring much to the party.
Barca were a shambles. It's just such an incoherent squad. Messi is unfortunately in the Ronaldo category now of fantastic footballer, can't move. Suarez, a slightly less good footballer, also can't move. And what that means is that they can't press anything like they used to a decade ago when they were actually a brilliant team. And the midfield just gets stretched. And anybody who runs that midfield gets through it. So, there's no way they'll beat Bayern in the quarterfinal. Something absolutely... For Barca to beat Bayern in this quarterfinal will be a bigger shock than Lyon beating Juventus. They're just a nonsense of a football club, an absolute disgrace.
I thought in this game one of the interesting things was Messi was pressing a bit more. I saw something new there. I kept thinking, who's that little bloke pressing, watching on the telly, and was shocked to find it was him. So, obviously, there's been some sort of, move to do that. But what I loved about his goal... was that he's been sort of, the last few years, he's been imperial Messi. It's been this wonderful gliding figure. But that was like Messi as a sort of cheeky little goblin, like when he was 20 and he would scrabble around on the floor, dribbling past four men. For Messi to be scrabbling on the floor and producing an incredible piece of skill was like a window back into Messi of old, which was really fun to watch. I don't think you can ever rule them out from beating anyone because he is just so good.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is true, that when Messi exists, all things are possible, yeah.
I love the idea that after scoring a goal like that, an analyst would look at you and go, you can't move, mate, sorry. So, yeah, Barca-Bayern. I guess the fact that it's just one leg does make it a less predictable game, doesn't it?
It does, but you look at the strength of that Bayern, you look at the pace they've got in forward areas, you look at something like Alphonso Davies, when he gets the ball at left back, how on earth are they going to pin him in? Messi's not going to be able to do this. So then whoever's playing on the right side midfield has to shift across, and that creates space for Thiago Alcantara and Joshua Kimmich. Messi creates so many... I mean, look, obviously a brilliant footballer, and that goal was a magnificent goal, but he creates so many issues with the way he can't press for at least protracted periods, even if he can do it for short periods. And this Bayern is so good all over the pitch that...
I would say there is shades of... it's sort of set up almost for a bit like what Liverpool did to Barca last year at Anfield, that something like that could happen because of the sheer mobility and coherence of the way they played. But I still would never agree that Messi is the problem in that team. He is a super strength which you can build a team around. The problem is not finding the parts to work with him. I mean, he is not a problem. This is kind of something in coaching that sometimes I think people focus a little bit on the negatives rather than the positives, which sounds very trite. But if you have Messi, that is, as I say, a super strength, which you've got to make everything work around that.
Yeah, but you know, that's exactly the point. That Barca for sort of 4 or 5 years and Argentina for forever have not really found a way to make it work. On a sort of theoretical level, I agree with you. I just think that given that nobody's been able to sort that out since he's stopping able to move, since sort of 2015, 2016-ish, it's sort of a fascinating, from a dramatic point of view, that he simultaneously is the incredible, luxurious wallpaper that covers over the cracks, and yet he's also made of lead-based paint, which is sort of slowly poisoning everybody at the same time.
Atalanta play PSG in the first quarter final on Wednesday night. Is this PSG's year, Barry?
No.
Oh. Will they win this game?
No, I can't see PSG ever winning this tournament.
Barney?
I think Barry is in an incredible turn of events wrong.
Right.
And that I've been tipping PSG all season. I think they're really a strong team, and that they have sorted a few problems in that team. It's a shame about Mbappe, although there's some talk that he might be back to play a bit in this game, and you can bet they'll get him out there somehow, whatever it takes. I think there's something, if you look at the sort of historical tectonic plates of football, the way they're shifting at the moment, where you can feel forces swirling above our heads, that City and PSG are destined to contest who wins the Champions League this year, and then gets to keep football as a result and walk off with it, and football's yours forever. That's probably how it will work.
So if they're destined to meet, who has destined that? Is that something that, I don't know, some witches have done, maybe?
You can fall back on your witches and your witch doctors, indeed, which you've already been talking about in this pod. No, it's the it's just a structuralist theory of history, isn't it? That forces, wider forces, make events happen, and that those wider forces speak to each other. And at the bottom of those wider forces, Neymar cost 220 million and is actually fit. And I have a feeling they're a very good team and they could win.
What if those witches were doing when they were cursing Tottenham wasn't actually casting a spell, but were merely reading the signs of these structural plates within history?
Well, which would perhaps preclude them from entrance into the International Witches Guild, that when their actual qualifications for witchery were studied, people would say, you're not actually witches at all, you're merely taking a sensible analysis of the actual facts of the situation, which I'm sorry to bring those things in when witches are obviously easier to just talk about witchery and curses. And
is it hard to get your witching license, or is it like the B license quite easy? And that allows you to sit on the bench for the A license, is what you really need.
Yeah, at that level, the kind of level we've hit on this pod. I mean, the likes of Barry, if you want to compete at that level, you must have absolutely no grasp of actual things, making things happen at all, and simply rely on your witch's instinct.
Well, I hope you're right about PSG, Barney, because quite frankly, being right about PSG season after season after season after season is getting boring. So I would love at some point for them to prove me wrong and actually perform impressively in the Champions League.
I do think, leaving witches and the deeper structural issues of history aside, the way that Atlanta press is not something that PSG come up against or anything resembling that in the French League. And given how Real Madrid bottled it as soon as they were pressed on Friday, you do wonder if there's a possibility something similar might happen. While I do agree with Barney that PSG probably look better and more balanced this season than they have done at any previous period under the Qatari ownership.
RB Leipzig Atletico's on Thursday. We'll talk about that on Thursday's pods. Atletico say after the discovery of two positive cases of coronavirus, there'll be another round of tests for the group headed to Lisbon for this game before they go and do that. To the Europa League. So Manchester United play FC Copenhagen tonight, Monday. Tomorrow is Wolves versus Sevilla. Wolves got past a stubborn Olympiacos who gave away a ridiculous penalty early on. Raul Jimenez scored it. Wolves rode their luck a little bit, conceded a goal that was ruled out for offside by one of those. His shoulder is just ahead of the defender's toe. But Sevilla is a sterner test, isn't it, Jonathan Wilson? They are a very good football team.
Well, I just think Olympiacos are pretty good. We saw against Tottenham that Olympiacos are a decent side, and they beat Arsenal. You know, they have a proven track record of playing well against upper mid table Premier League teams. So for Wolves to beat them, I think is not an achievement to be looked down upon. I mean, well, they looked to an extent, but you know, I thought they held their own in the game. It wasn't that they were sort of under siege. Sevilla are also a good side. I'd sort of say they're roughly equivalent of level to Olympiacos.
Barry, did you see the pictures of Adama Traore having his arms oiled before the game? And what is your reaction?
I did see them. I had heard this was a thing, all right, and one of the backroom staff were oiling him up, apparently to prevent opposition players from grabbing his arms, being able to get a grip on them as they try to stop him whizzing past them at great speed. I suppose if it's fine. I don't like the smell of baby oil, so I wouldn't be that keen on marking him if he was slathered in it. I also was a bit surprised he had someone to do it for him, that he didn't just apply it himself. But apparently that would leave his hands covered in oil, rendering him unable to take throw-ins and grab hold of opposition players. And clearly they haven't heard of the towel at Wolves, which you can, you know, dry your hands after applying baby oil or whatever lubricant it was.
I don't think that would work, Barry. I think it's really disgusting stuff. It kind of gets everywhere. It's really vile. I can see why they do. It's like putting that anti-vandal paint. You'll never get that stuff off and it will stain your... I don't think they're going far enough. I mean, he should maybe have his... Remember the Sun used to get Page Three girls to paint the colours of a team in the FA Cup final. They'd have two Page Three girls with Crystal Palace, and maybe they should just paint his shirt on with extra slippery paint.
Manchester United, the only team Crystal Palace have played in FA Cup finals.
Indeed.
Thank you, yes. Thank you for adding a fact to that, Jonathan Wilson. Much needed. Would you oil yourself up for a live show, Barry?
No. The chances of anyone trying to grab a hold of me during a live show are pretty minimal. So
we thought we got close in Leeds at that time, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, there is that.
Rangers went out to buy Leverkusen. You watched this, Barry. Was it fun?
Yeah. Rangers needed to score three goals. They lost 1-0, which meant they needed to score three goals to stay in the tie. They never laid a glove on Bayer Leverkusen. It was men against boys, largely. They defended quite well. Alfredo Morelos was a disgrace, totally disinterested, barely got a touch and was taken off. He has had his head turned by Lille, apparently, but he played better for Rangers over the weekend. He's expected to leave in the next week or two, I suspect.
All right, we'll do Fitbar after the break. Basel beat Eintracht Frankfurt 1-0, 4-0 on aggregate. So, Monday, Man United versus FC Copenhagen and Inter versus Bayer Leverkusen, Wolf Sevilla and Shakhtar versus Basel on Tuesday. We'll chat about them on Thursday's pod with Nicky Bandini and Jordan Jarrett. Brian, right now, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Fitbar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Fitbar Corner, Barry. The title race is over and Celtic are out of it.
That's correct. And Hibs are surged clear with Rangers and Ross County. They're all on 6 points each. Celtic back on fourth, back in fourth with a mere 4 points after their draw at Kilmarnock, 1-1. Ryan Christie put Celtic ahead with a free kick from at least 35 yards, if not further out. Dipping shot, Kilmarnock keeper probably should have done better. Nicky Kabamba was the star player for Kilmarnock. He gave the Celtic centre-halves a very torrid afternoon. and he was taken down by Christopher Julien to win a penalty, which was scored by Chris Burke. So good result for Kilmarnock there. Rangers beat St Mirren 3-0 after their exit from Europe. And Morelos, as I say, was disgracefully bad on Thursday night, but he scored a couple and created one, which were his first goals since February, although they haven't played that often since February, it should be noted. And Rangers assigned two strikers last week, Kamar Roof from formerly Leeds, they signed him from Anderlecht, and Cedric Itten, who's a Swiss international, signed him from St. Gallen, which sort of adds further fuel to the speculation that Morelos is on his way out. I was talking to a guy I know yesterday who is a Rangers fan, and I think Lille have had a bid, I don't know how much for, rejected by Rangers, but he reckons Rangers should just snap their hand off because he thinks Morelos is more trouble than he's worth. And I suppose the big story of the weekend was the postponement of Aberdeen's game against St. Johnson.
Yes, I just want to hold you there, Barry, because there was a quote on Aberdeen discussing their performance on the opening day on last Monday's pod, where, direct quote from you, Barry, yes, he says, as a fella I was watching it with said, those fellas couldn't pass the COVID virus to each other. And it turns out they absolutely could.
Well, yes. After their game against Rangers, I think 8 or 10 of them went out drinking at some bar in Aberdeen city centre. There's been a spike in coronavirus cases in Aberdeen, and 2 of them tested positive, and I think 6 or 8 more are self-isolating. So their game was postponed. There was talk they might have to forfeit the game, but it was postponed. And they got a ticking off from no less a luminary than Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, who said, to say this incident is deeply regrettable is an understatement. I'm pretty furious about this situation because it shouldn't have happened. If the guidance is not going to be adhered to, then all bets are off. So that's the Scottish First Minister, very, very cross with Aberdeen's players. Derek McInnes gave a press conference about it. He was quite bashful, saying, you know, it's ridiculous that this happened. The players should have known better. And the players involved issued a very craven, grovelling apology for their stupidity.
On the subject of politicians, Barry, you'll notice Boris Johnson weighing into the debate over whether the Premier League should make a statement about the collapsed Saudi takeover of Newcastle United. On tomorrow's pods, Philippe Auclair, David Conn and James Dorsey will join me, and we're going to do a long chat about Gulf states getting involved in football and hopefully shed a bit more light on that and react to that. Chris says, is the salary cap good for League One and League Two? Clubs voted for a limit of 2.5 million in League One, 1.5 million in League Two. Wages, bonuses, taxes and image rights plus agents and other relevant fees will be included within the cap. But bonuses gained from promotion or progression in cups will be exempt. Clubs will be fined or face further sanctions if they exceed the limits. The PFA reacted to the vote by saying it's disappointed with the outcome. Wilson, what do you think?
I think it's complete nonsense. You can't set a figure, an absolute figure, and expect it to apply equally to use the League One examples. Sunderland, whose average crowd is 30,000, and Accrington, whose average crowd is 5,000. They're working with two completely different sized pots. I don't see why the bigger clubs, who are generating revenue totally legitimately from their fan base, should be penalised in that way. I've got all sympathy with a very strictly monitored salary cap in terms of proportion of revenues, but to unilaterally impose sort of an absolute figure seems to me almost a deliberate attempt to undermine the bigger clubs in that division. And it also means the gulf that already exists between the Championship and League One, and you look at the teams coming down from the Championship this season, that gulf already exists. That's going to get wider and wider and wider. So it's almost like the groundwork of Premier League 2 is being prepared by the League 1 and League 2 clubs.
And let's face it, Sunderland don't need help undermining their effort to get out of League 1. They're doing a sterling job of undermining it themselves.
I mean, the positive way to look at it is Sunderland, for now, have the highest level of academy you can get. So you would hope that's producing players. And if it's forced some to actually use them, I mean, the only one who's come through recently is Denver Hume. But obviously, you look further back, you've got Jordan Pickford, Jordan Henderson. If suddenly Sunderland end up with a core of sort of 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who've kind of come through their academy and have some sort of emotional attachment to the club, then maybe that can be a positive in the future. But it just makes it even harder for Sunderland to get promoted, a job they're making look pretty difficult anyway.
There was a difficulty in imposing a salary cap in League One and League Two, but not having it in the Championship and the National League. Tom Greatrex, who's an expert on this kind of things and works for the Football Supporters Association, amongst other things, was saying you could have a situation where a National League side pay their players more or have a bigger wage budget than a League Two side, and so those players would be trying to win promotion to then have to have a pay cut to get into League Two. But on the flip side, look, it's the start of regulation that needs to happen. It's getting the detail right that also matters.
Well, yes, but it's just a stupid way of doing it. It's a way that means that nobody's really going to go along with it. Everybody's going to be frustrated by it. Any club of any stature is going to be frustrated by it. Because it hampers, you know, what are they going to do with that money that they've got left over? Is it just going to build up in a bank account? I mean, I know they could spend it on interest.
They could reduce the price of tickets, maybe. That would be a good thing.
That's really not the issue at Sunderland. Ticket prices at Sunderland are already, as low as it realistically can be. But, I mean, I don't know, maybe they can buy in the city a pint, which would be nice, but it doesn't really seem what football club revenue should be used for.
No, you're right. I mean, penalising people for being popular, which is obviously a problem we've all experienced. And it doesn't make any sense. Like, there is legitimate revenue to be earned by being a good community club and attracting more fans, and you should be allowed to use that to improve your team. This seems like a slightly blunt and clumsy instrument.
A couple of important points from last week's pods. A note about Archie Rintoul's celebrations after Fulham's opener. He bumped into his neighbour in the stairwell the next day, who said, "Did you hear that commotion last night? I called the police." A note about Breda Hangeland and talking about him getting a coffee before training. He tweeted to say that he will buy me a flat white from Monmouth Coffee the next time he is in London. So hello to Breda. Serious question from Council Pop. How do we know Wilson isn't just making all the stuff up about Alloa Athletic, playing a six-man midfield in 1921, goalies wearing gloves last century, and Austria inventing tiki-taka? Has anyone checked it out?
I mean, people are welcome to check it out.
I think Jonathan Wilson is renowned in football circles as one of the very few journalists with integrity. I believe every word he writes. I don't read any of them, but I believe them.
Matthew says, would you rather die from a crossbow arrow to the face or eat your mate's nail clippings for 4 to 5 years, Barney?
Would that be fatal? Would you die of eating those nail clippings? Probably not.
I don't have that detail.
Could you eat them like a dog, you know, unwittingly? Would someone crush them into your dinner so you don't actually know you're eating them?
I think I could cook something with those nail clippings. It would actually be fine. You'd probably soften them. You'd marinate them overnight to soften them. And then you'd use them for texture in a dish.
As somebody with recent experience, can I just say that eating challenges aren't necessarily as easy as they seem at first sight?
And look, that'll do for today, won't it? I hope you've all had a wonderful time. Barney, did you have a wonderful time?
Yeah, it's definitely the most wonderful time I've had so far today.
Great. Jonathan Wilson?
Yeah, of course I did, yeah.
Great. Barry?
I had a wonderful time, which has only been enhanced by discovering, as I suspected, some sound issues we had to deal with earlier were Barney's fault, despite his insistence that they couldn't possibly be. So that has made my day so far.
If anyone has got to this part of the podcast because the first hour of it had severe audio issues, please lay the blame at Barney Ronay on social media. But be kind about it. Just say we know it was your fault. Do you have anything to say, Barney?
Well, obviously that's not true. But I'm not surprised to hear you say it.
Thank you, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.